You're listening to the Evolving Leader Podcast. In this show, John is joined by Kevin Kelly, Senior Maverick at Wired Magazine. Kevin co-founded Wired in 1993 and served as its executive editor for its first 7 years. His most recent book is The Inevitable, which is a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller. His other books include the best-selling New Rules for the New Economy, the classic Out of Control, and his summary theory of technology in What Technology Wants. And from 1984 to 1990, Kelly was publisher and editor of the counterculture Bible, The Whole Earth Catalog. He co-founded the Hackers Conference and was involved with the launch of The Well, a pioneering online service started in 1985. He also founded the ever useful and often surprising Cool Tools website in 2003.
So, Kevin, we're delighted to have you on the show, not least that we seem to be at yet another point where the influence of the web and e-commerce and all of those things on our lives has now entered yet another phase in its political, social, and economic impact. If you step back from the big picture, what is on your mind right now? Because you're a thinker, and I'm sure you must have had a lot of profound kind of reflections in the last few months.
So at the broadest level, I would say that I am expecting an economic and prosperity boom globally in the next 15 years, we'll say. So I think we're kind of poised to have another leap forward on average, globally on average. Now, of course, there are going to be plenty of exceptions in places and pockets of the world where things will go backwards. But in general, I think there is a bunch of different forces and drivers that converge to say the next 15 years are going to be amazing with progress. So that would be the kind of the large scale background. Specifically, I think we're going to grapple with, the continuation of AI entering into our worlds in many different ways, many different consequences, good and bad. And so we're going to be dealing with that. And I think the number one social issue is going to be this privacy surveillance thing, which doesn't have easy answers. And it's also very tied to the AI machine learning thing because it right now requires a lot of data. So there's a kind of a more of the same change at one level, where we're going to have AI infiltrate more of our lives. And but it's not necessarily going to happen all at once overnight. Self-driving cars are still 10 years or more away. Electric cars are very close. They're going to happen very fast, I think, in 5 years. But self-driving cars, we'll be dealing with that for decades, just dealing with issues and what it means and stuff like that. It's not going to happen overnight. But it will continue, and it will make new jobs, and it will shift how we do things and how we travel. So, again, the broadest strokes, prosperity, globally, on average, specifically, more AI coming into our workplace, no matter what we do, the social issues of privacy and surveillance becoming really, really big and gnarly, meaning that there are no real easy answers to that. So that's sort of my first broad stroke impressions.
Can we go back 24 years to the New Rules for the New Economy, where you had a very clear sense of how the digital revolution would unfold and play out? You certainly foresaw the rise of exponential growth organizations on the back of what you called the network economy's dumb power and plentitude, and plenty more besides. I mean, it was a very prescient book, and you articulated it in a way that was so clear at the time. When you look back at those ideas, which I seem to recall was in a very optimistic time as well in the mid-90s. Can you tell us how you think the development of technology has played out in those 2.5 decades?
Well, I've been kind of, as you suggest, I'm an old guy. I've been around this a long time. We really kind of, the internet began actually in the 80s in a certain sense, but it took 10 years for it to kind of dawn on the mainstream. And for those 10 years, we were kind of preaching what was going to happen. And there was a lot of unbelief. There was a lot of dismissal that the internet was consequential and real. I mean, I remember a New York Times tech columnist just declaring that this online shopping thing was hugely overrated as an idea, that no one would ever buy a car online. You're not going to buy bananas online. That was just silly to imagine people shopping online mainstream. And that's one of many kind of mindsets that were very skeptical of this thing. And so I would say one of the things that happened was many things that we talked about did in fact happen. We migrated a huge amount of our life online. And of course, the recent COVID was just another example of that. The kind of technology of using Zoom has been around. It wasn't that much different 20 years ago. It's just that finally people were forced to use it and they say, this works better than I thought. And so that's sort of where we are. It's sort of like the picture that we were trying to paint of a life, a digital life, more or less arrived. It did happen. And without a super amount of change, it was sort of kind of like as we were talking about. Now, there were aspects of it, and Wired was involved in it, in kind of preaching this as a panacea for democracy and all that kind of stuff. And I wouldn't say that probably did not happen. That part of the political part of it didn't happen. You know, John Perry Barlow's famous Manifesto of Independence, which, you know, this is going to be a completely independent world. I never believed that. I ran the piece because I thought it was provocative. But nonetheless, it's clear that this is not a separate place, that it has all the same problems and maybe more that pester the real world in terms of political and bias and all those kind of things. They're also present in the digital arena. So it didn't turn out to be an independent place. It turned out to be an integrated place. And that was actually my talk in the New Rules of New Economy, was that don't think of this digital as being kind of separate from it. The real revolution was that we were going to embed the virtual into the physical. And that hasn't fully completed yet, but that's where we're going. Is that it's not that there's two separate worlds, the digital, disembodied, intangible world, and then the physical world. No. The whole point of it, the whole real revolution, is that we're going to embed and put in the digital into the physical, and the two will merge together. And that's sort of the next thing that's coming with smart glasses and AR is where we take those two things and fully integrate the two together. So I would say that was maybe one misconception about the digital world that still remains, is people imagine them as separate worlds. And I think, no, the whole point of it is that they're not separate, that the two are integrated together.
So you've had this incredible track record in predicting how technology is going to play out. What's your process? How do you do this? Because one of the things that, you know, surprised me when I read an interview with you some years ago was that I wouldn't say a Luddite, but you're not somebody who really embraces the technology at a personal level that much.
Right. I think she myself is a minimalist rather than a maximalist. Yeah. But I do kind of make it my job to try everything as much as I can. I have no obligation to continue using things because I think there's a price that we pay for every bit of technology we adopt. There's a maintenance price. There's a psychic price. There's a whole bunch of, there's costs. And so I'm very selective about what I actually kind of make it my habit to use. But I am very promiscuous and generous in trying things, because I think it's only by trying things that we can actually understand them. I mean, we can think about them, we can read about them, but, you know, you've got to use TikTok a little bit. to kind of get a feel for what it is and what it does. And so doesn't mean that I don't have TikTok on my phone, because that's dangerous, but I will try it, and I'll kind of try it enough to kind of get a sense of what it's about. So the method is to experiment and try and try through use as much as possible, because I think it's only by using technologies that we understand them and that we get to steer them, by the way, too. And so if I was interested in trying to steer game technology, I would be using it, because that is the only way you get to vote. So that's the first thing, is through use. The second thing is I try to pay attention to where technologies are being abused, or misused is a better term. One of the things I discovered from my research in doing the What Technology Wants book was that most inventors of technologies don't have any kind of a clear picture of how their technologies will ultimately be used. They are also making predictions about what they think this thing is good for, and they're usually wrong. It will usually pivot in some ways, and the ultimate use of it is usually not the first idea that even the inventors have. And so I pay a lot of attention to how other people use the technologies that have been invented, which are sometimes classified as a misuse. So that could be how criminals use it. It could be how the renegades and mavericks, outsiders use it, how kids use it. And that's often will give you a little bit more of a sense of where it's headed, because they aren't being constrained by what they think it should be used, and they're kind of more responding to this actual biases. So that's the second thing, is to see how it's being used on the margins, because that may tell you how the center will use it later on. The third thing I call listening to the technology. And by that I mean, one of the things that critics have absolutely correct about technology is that each one has a bias. If there's biases and agendas built into the very nature of the technology, and that all things being equal, it will tend to go in certain direction. I disagree with some of the critics, because I think often those directions are positive. But nonetheless, there are agendas and biases and leanings and tendencies and urges built into technologies. And so listening to the technology is what I call where you are trying to see where it wants to go, where it tends to move towards. What in it is bias? And an example that I use is this bias in the digital technology to copy itself, to be copied, to copy perfectly and replicate it. And the early part of the digital revolution, there was people who were outraged by the fact that you could copy things perfectly. And so they had copy protection, and there was all kinds of things to stop the copying. We have music. We don't want you to copy the music. We have a movie. We're going to prohibit you from copying it. We'll make some technology that prevents you from copying it. And those were all working against the very nature of the digital technology. And if you were listening to the technology, you understand that copying was an inherent quality of this thing, and it was going to copy no matter what we did. And you're not going to be able to stop the copying, and you have to kind of work with the fact that everything's going to be copied. And that, for me, is an example of listening to the technology.
When you listen to social media, and this in your way of thinking about it, what does that want? What does social media want? How is it evolving?
That's a great question, and exactly the right question. I would say what social media wants is it wants our attention, and it wants to watch us all the time. And there's a kind of really curious thing about the social media practitioners, is like they kind of like they want to be famous, but they don't want anybody to know their private life or something. I mean, it's like they want to be famous, but they don't want to be known. It was like, okay, you can't have one without the other. So the way I say it is that, okay, here's what it is. Social media wants transparency, and it wants transparency across the board. So if you have transparency, then you don't really have any privacy. But the advantage of transparency is that you have personalization. People treat you as an individual. So if you want to be treated as an individual, then you have to be transparent. And you can't push the slider and say, I want to be treated personally and I want to have personalization, but I don't want anybody to know about me. That does not compute. So you kind of have to move the slider. And what we know about social media so far is that when people have a chance to move that slider, they're going to push it all the way to the transparency and personalization side. So social media wants transparency and personalization, but that's the cost of it. And so if you try to say, well, I just want one part of that, you're not listening to what it wants.
Yeah. And that's so interesting, because as you start to think about these other technologies that are converging into our world, and you talked about augmented reality being the big kind of win there, is kind of immediate access to information in real time, the ability to apply it into real situations. So what does the technology want, and what's the cost in that respect?
So the question is, like, do you want to have generic ads, or do you want to actually have ads that are personal to you? And that's a good question. If you say, well, I want them to advertise without knowing who I am. So I'll get ads for flower dresses, for spring flower dresses. I'm fine seeing that. Or no, you say, no, actually, I want them to target ads to my own interests in, you know, workshop tools. Well, the cost of that is going to be, I have to reveal my behavior, my preferences. And so that's a question most people haven't actually grappled with or don't have a really good answer to, is do you want to be bothered with things that you care about only or not? And it's actually a question we aren't really answering ourselves yet. I mean, to be honest, I don't know my answer. Do I want the advertising technology to be really, really good? Or do I want it to be lousy?
Well,
in a certain sense, I want it to be lousy because I don't want it to work on me. In the other sense, I want it to be good because I don't want to be bothered with all this other crap. So, yeah.
But I mean, I suppose that the other question is, I don't want it at all. You know, how do I avoid it? And I guess
exactly. Right. And so would I pay for versions of things like Facebook or Google that had no ads? Absolutely. How much would I pay for Google a year? Well, that's the question you want to be asking yourself. I'd pay, I don't know, $400 a year for Google without any ads at all. And, you know, Hal Varian and other people at Google, the in-house economists, have calculated almost exactly what they believe people would be willing to pay and or how much they believe that the true value of Google is. Right now, we don't even value how valuable Google is. They did a great, great, great experiment many, many years ago where they had people try to get the same answers that Google would give you at a library, counted up how many hours it took and multiplied by some hourly number and said, that's the value of Google. And it's even more than that, because most of the answers in Google, you couldn't even get at a library. So we haven't fully internalized or even economically recognized the value of the digital world that we have, because so much of it is being offered as free, being, you know, supported by this attention economy. But I think we're going to, you know, Substack and other innovations have shown that we've been educated, that we're being educated to understand the value and to pay for things up front. And I think we'll come to a point where we'll have the opportunity to buy the privacy without having to see ads, to buy versions like Netflix kind of was, where you can buy your way out of the advertising economy.
So one book that I always recommend to leaders who are trying to grow their businesses and navigate the digital economy is one of your most recent ones, The Inevitable, The 12 Technological Forces Shaping Our Future. And we can see some of those, such as accessing, you know, that point where society shifts from owning assets to where we have access to them at all times. And streaming music services is a good example of the acceleration of that. And some of them potentially dystopian, you could argue, like total, you know, the surveillance economy and constant interacting. Be really interested in your thoughts on how those forces, those 12 forces, or the ones that really stick out for you, have evolved in the last half decade since you wrote the book.
Well, I think one of the chapters that I might amend slightly was the chapter on screenings, and the basic beginning premise was that our world would be, we increasingly have more and more screens, we have more time in front of screens. The screens can be hugely varied in terms of little tiny handheld screens on our phones to big screens on the side of buildings, in like at least in China, where they have cities that are the cityscape, it becomes a huge screen. And what I didn't really talk about was this idea of having smart glasses where the screens were something that you wore the screen on your face and you were seeing through them constantly. So basically the screens were everywhere you looked. And that whole mirror world, I call it, is, again, going back to my premise of the convergence of the digital and the physical, that's what we would see. These would be devices that would show us this merged world, where overlay onto the real world that we could see through these clear glasses would be the virtual digital twin of that entire world at the same scale in the same place. And that had tremendous potential for training, learning, working, playing, navigating, shopping. And that's an additional enhancement of my original vision. But the others, filtering and accessing, I stand by them. I wouldn't change very much about them. I think they're still going, and it was a long view to begin with anyway, that I wasn't giving dates. Predictions with dates just don't work. I see predictions, the kind I talk about, as directions, a general direction that we're headed into. The specifics are inherently unpredictable. That's what we know about simulations in the world, is that you can never predict specifics, like what company, what date. The best we can do with these is talk about general trends and directions. And so that's sort of what I was indicating. These are directions and not destinies.
As you look at this world now that's dominated with huge companies like Amazon and Twitter and Facebook and so on, all of which you had a hand in inspiring, I guess, because you envisaged a lot of how this would play out.
Right. And by the way, you neglected to mention a Tencent,
yes,
Alibaba,
yeah,
of which is a common stake in America and maybe the West, is to ignore the elephant in the room. But anyway, continue. So there are these big companies, including the ones in China.
Yeah. So what do you think are the real leadership challenges? Not the technological ones, but the real leadership challenges, so that these technologies and these companies continue to bring out a healthy impact in society. What would you like to, you know, if you could be a mentor to the people running these organizations, say to them?
To those companies, well, first of all, I would say to them, I would remind them is, your run is limited. Your time is limited as a dominant thing. That the history that we know, and particularly the emerging history, the short history of platforms, is that these are ephemeral. These are ephemeral natural monopolies that will be displaced by the next platform, which is coming very rapidly. So make the most of it while you are, because GM is, no one's paying attention to GM. Even IBM, which was, you know, or AT&T, all these big companies that were these huge monopolies within my lifetime, within my adult lifetime. And so they're going to go. And Facebook is, you know, dominant, but it's not going to be in 15 years. and all the big companies plan in their own head. They imagine themselves as being the dominant player in AI or whatever's coming, VR with Facebook, AR. But it's almost certain that the dominant monopolist of the next generation will be an outsider. That's just how it works. And the reason is, and this is the advice to the leadership of this, is that their success is a prison. They're imprisoned by their success. And they're imprisoned by their success because the next big revolution is going to come from an area that is at first unprofitable, doesn't work well, low quality, tiny margins, small markets. It's just all the places you don't want to do business. And the only reason why the startups are doing business there is they have no choice. They don't have any money. They have to scrape and figure these things out. And so they're the ones who come up with the innovation and the business model and everything else. And then they network effects come in and they boom and they take over. And the big expensive companies just can't afford to do that. They simply cannot afford to run a business and devote huge amounts of time and effort into these marginal places. And so what that means is that their time is limited. They have, whatever it is, another 10 years to be dominant. They're not going to go away. Microsoft didn't go away, but it's not really a player. I mean, it's big. It's got a lot of money. So so that would be the first thing. It's okay. You have another decade to make a difference. The second thing I would say about the platforms is the platforms are brand new and we don't even know what to make of them. They are quasi-governmental. They're kind of like, they take on a lot of the functions that government used to do, and they don't have any of the kind of responsibilities or few of the responsibilities of government. And I would say every time we have a right, there should be a corresponding responsibility. If there are digital rights, there are digital responsibilities. If you have some of the privileges of a monopolist, then you have to have some of the responsibilities to offset that. And so part of what we're doing right now is we are trying to figure out how we society regulate them. But if we try to regulate them as companies, it doesn't work. If we try to regulate them as governments, that doesn't work. There are a third thing. There are new, or sometimes they're called fourth thing. They're not a nonprofit organization. They are kind of a new type of genre of organization. And we don't want to try and fit them into, your corporation. Well, you have some forms of some of the aspects of government. Let's imagine this as a brand new thing that would need new rules and new ideas about how to govern it. And that, by the way, applies to some of the things like Uber drivers and Airbnbs. It's like Uber driver is definitely not an employee. They're also not just a contractor. They're something else. And we should be ready to kind of make up new categories to understand them. And we've been very, very slow about that. So I would go back to the advice to the leaders of this and to say, help regulators and help politicians understand that we really need to make a new categories about how we treat these platforms that you're running.
So we're really interested on this show about how leaders can balance short and long-term thinking, something which I know you've been invested in. You were a founder member of the Long Now Foundation, which was established to be a counterpoint to faster, cheaper mindset of Silicon Valley and business in general, and promote slower, better thinking. Can you tell us a little bit about why you set it up and what impact do you think it's had on people's thinking in the last 25 years?
Yeah, it's, again, a really great question. So the Long Now Foundation was founded, and I was one of the co-founders, to promote and foster long-term thinking, to make it common and automatic instead of rare and difficult. And I think we've been successful in at least introducing the idea, and there are a number of people, both in governments, within the nonprofits, within corporations and in organizations and individuals who understand the need for this and how it's better. And COVID was a fantastic example of why you want to think long term, because there are tons of studies and institutions and institutional knowledge about how to deal with a pandemic and the fact that the pandemic was inevitable. And I worked on several of these scenario workshops of people who prepare. So in a certain sense, we had that capacity to it, but the attitude, the perspective of taking that long term and really taking it seriously was not widespread. So we were caught off guard. But in a certain sense, there were people who in the professions who knew this was inevitable, who could describe exactly how this was going to happen and will happen again. And so so we have the very, very, very beginning of this. And I think we have kind of a dawning awareness that long now in the 25 years of being alive have tried to kind of seed. So there are a lot of people who can begin to use that vocabulary. And part of our agenda, a long-term agenda in the next 25 years, is to make it into a field or a discipline where it's taught in schools, where there are scholarly academic best practices on this. We're not there yet, but that's what we've begun. So I think we've succeeded in kind of introducing the idea. We haven't succeeded in making it mainstream or common, but that's what we're working on. And the benefit of this is that you can work on things that take more than a quarter business cycle to complete or produce. There are many things in our society today that exist because they spent 25 years making it, cathedrals or road systems and things like that, that were not completed even within the lifetime of the people who started. And that's the promise, is that we can embark and scale up things that may take a generation or two to complete. And this is particularly true when we think globally. And that's going back to maybe your first question. I would say that's another aspect of what's happening right now. I think the drive towards globalization will continue and we'll become more global in the next 15 years than we have been, and maybe more truly global. So we have global problems that can only be solved with global solutions, global cooperation, global collaboration. And one of the things that kind of planetary scale allows us is that it may require a more generational thinking to do things. So climate change is going to be a generational job. And taking a long-term view, we can begin to do something and not have to think that, well, we're going to have results next year or even 2 years. We may be pushing the benefits down to another generation, saying we're going to start something and we're not going to see any benefits, but your grandchildren will see benefits. Wow. That suddenly opens up a whole bunch of things and it can help us become a little bit more optimistic about our world, because we can say, well, we can start to do things now with climate that maybe we won't see, but your grandchildren will see.
Here on The Evolving Leader, we are committed to stretching the leadership conversation in every episode, and we invite you to help spread the word. If you have learned or been inspired by something you heard on this podcast, chances are others would too. Please consider sharing your favorite episode with your network on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Instagram. Thanks for listening.
So you're optimistic about how the economy is going to fare in the next decade or so. What's the things that you've been seeing on solving those big problems like climate, education, health, and so on that you're most excited about?
One of them is energy. Green energy, but specifically electrification, electrifying. I go along with a researcher here in the U.S., Saul Griffith, who worked with the U.S. government to kind of map out a pathway that would be a reasonable kind of a goal for a green energy system. And his conclusion was that we electrify everything. We move to electric everything as fast as possible. Basically, we stop burning anything. and we make electricity through solar, wind, nuclear, hydro, nuclear. And that alone, just simply electrifying everything, immediately reduces the energy consumption. It's much more efficient. It reduces the greenhouse effect. It was like half of what we want, is basically what he says. Half of what we aim for, we can get just simply by electrifying everything that we're doing right now, and not changing anything else, just electrifying it. So we here in the Bay Area, in our house, we run our heat all year round just to bring it up to room temperature because it's so cool in the fog. Well, what we want, or what I should be having, is a heat pump. So instead of burning natural gas, is what we do right now, we should have a heat pump, which is kind of like a air conditioner that works in reverse. So it moves the heat from outside into your home. And it works in the same principle as a air conditioner, but it's just in reverse. In fact, some of the units can be reversed, so you can heat or cool. But they're more efficient than burning gas. They cost more right now, so there's an upfront cost. But we should electrify everything, electrify cooking, electrify our vehicles, electrify even, amazingly, airplanes. That was the really holy grail, was jet fuel is kerosene is just so energy dense. It really is a remarkable energy source, and gasoline and kerosene. It was hard to see how we could ever have a commercial airplane that was running on batteries. But battery technology is still, it's almost on Moore's laws, it's still improving so fast that we now can imagine electric commercial air flight. It may not be in these giant planes, the scale that we're having now with jet fuel, but they could be commercial flights flying maybe in smaller vehicles. And these flying cars are running on electric batteries. And that would be part of this shift. So to answer your question, I'm very optimistic about green energy. I think it's actually we can see how we could do it. I am optimistic about AI, as I mentioned, liberating people from jobs they don't do. A lot of the jobs that people fight over are basically jobs humans should not be doing at all, and that we'll be embarrassed in the future that humans were even doing these things. Like being a cashier, counting money. What? That's a waste of a human potential. So AI is another force, I think, that is going to be bringing prosperity, changing people's jobs, making whole new jobs that don't exist today, removing jobs that people really don't want to do. And I think the other one is the change in food. I'm very, very excited. As someone who doesn't eat mammals, beef, pork, I'm very excited by the lab-grown meats, where you replicate everything you love about meat, except you don't have death. You don't have death involved. You don't have animals involved, and you don't have the kind of the whole animal husbandry aspect. There will be people eating meat, animal meat, forever, but it just won't necessarily become the most affordable, dominant way. It'll be a luxury, and that's fine. But we're going to be making lab-grown meat in better, that tastes better, and it is nutritionally better than the meat you can get from a wild animal, and seafood. And that's the main thing, is removing our decimation of the oceans, having wild national, wild parks, places where we don't fish at all, restoring that. So that, believe it or not, will be prosperity. It's like one of the ways we recognize prosperity in America is that we have national parks. it's very hard to assign an economic value to it, but psychically, national parks are part of it's part of the good part of modern life. And so part of that prosperity that I see is not just all economic, it's also kind of psychological, and that would be having oceans where we aren't killing them by eating all the, by overfishing them, basically.
How has your time during COVID been? You all seem to have so many projects going on. Did the pandemic spark something new in you?
Well, it allowed me to finish a project that I was working on for 50 years, which was my Vanishing Asia photo book. So I spent 50 years traveling in very remote parts of Asia, photographing the disappearing culture. I took, half a million images over those 50 years, and I selected the 9,000 best ones, put them into a book of 1,000 pages plus. And actually, the book became so big, I divided it into three volumes, and I did a Kickstarter. And that's about to be printed next week in Turkey, in Istanbul. So that is just a huge amount of work. And I did that during COVID. Instead of traveling, I was at home putting together this opus to the otherness, the differences found in Asia that are quickly disappearing, even within Asia. And it's a kind of a testament or testimonial to thinking different. And my little rant on that is that Steve Jobs, Apple was right. Think different is the engine of the new economy. It's how wealth and everything good else, innovation comes from, is by thinking different. And the more social media, the more we're connected 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day of the year with each other around the world, the harder it is to think different. So we have the problem of a group mind when we're all connected to each other around the world all the time. And I see my little journeys to these remote parts in Asia that are disappearing as one way to capture some difference, different ways of solving the same problems we all have of, clothing, shelter, food. Here are people doing it very differently. And some of these ideas can be recycled or amended or enhanced into the modern world. Go to the Kumbh Mela in India, where they have 30 million people on a beach, and you can see the future of Burning Man and more. And so, outdoor festivals or festivals of any type with millions of people. That's what I did with this book called Vanishing Asia.
Yeah, I saw some pictures online. Looks incredibly impressive and very heavy as well. So,
yes.
Good luck with that. It sounds amazing. You spent your youth traveling and in a kind of discovery mode, which opened your mind up to all sorts of different perspectives. What advice would you give the young today as the world starts to become more knowable and we can, just look online and think we know what's going on? Where do you think they should place their efforts across the different dimensions of their lives?
Right. Well, you already hinted at the major one, which is I think travel is so important for young people that I think it should be subsidized and almost to some extent mandated, but certainly subsidized by governments. There's nothing more that would change the U.S. Than having every young person spend 2 years outside the country. Man, that would be the best dividend for peace dividend in the world. It would just transform business. It would just transform the country because you would be mixing with people who weren't from your own bubble. And the value of encountering and having to make your way, no matter what level you traveled at, would be so much more transformative than college I really think it's essential for any young person. If you have a chance, if you have any means at all, if you have any way to do traveling outside of your home country, do it. You will never regret it, and it will really transform you. And so That would be the first thing. The second one would be there's kind of common advice about following your bliss, but my experience with young people is they often have no idea what their bliss is, and they get stymied and stuck and paralyzed because they don't want to do anything until they know what they want to do. And my kind of career advice is something simpler, which is master something. Even if it's a random thing, even if someone else assigns it to you, even if it's a job that you know you got, just become world class at something. And that mastery of that, if you continue to master it, put in your 10,000 hours doing it, 10,000 hours of deliberate practice, meaning 10,000 hours of trying to get better, not just doing it, but 10,000 hours of trying to improve what you're doing, that momentum will move you. That will be the vehicle to move you towards your bliss. In other words, you will discover your bliss through becoming masters of something. And also, by the way, that master of something is, you know, keep you alive and going while you drift towards your bliss. So rather than follow your bliss, maybe I would say drift towards your bliss.
That's a really great advice. You've been involved in so many enriching projects over the years. I don't want to be reductive, but I can't help but ask, what if you were going to take, you know, a central idea that you'd be proud that future generations took from your thinking, what might it be?
Well, I try to engineer a theory of technology. So technology right now, even though it's sort of like the most important thing I believe in culture, I'm a very technocentric view of the world. We don't really have a very good theory about it. And it's still a bit like biology was before Darwin, where they have these curiosity cabinets of all these specimens from around the world, and there's no real logic. There's just one curious thing after another. And that's sort of how we've been with technology, is this one curious invention after another. And there hasn't been a sense of how they're connected together. And my attempt to make a theory of technology is to say that it's an extension of biology. It's an extension of evolution. It's the seventh kingdom of life. The same forces that work through the Big Bang and made life on this planet and our own thinking is being accelerated, is continuing through the technium, through technology. And the technology is really not a human thing. It's a cosmic thing. And the consequence of all that, or the takeaway of all that, is that when we're involved in making things, even trivial, stupid consumer things, we're involved in increasing the number of options and opportunities in the world, which is what the general trend of life is. And that therefore that we have a moral duty to increase the technology in the world, because we're equipping more people who are born or yet to be born to find that particular tool that will allow their genius to be shared. Because, you know, imagine Mozart being born before we invented pianos. What a shame that would have been for us and for him if he'd been born before the symphony, or if Van Gogh had been born before we had cheap oil paint on canvas. All that would have been lost. So we have a moral duty to increase the tools and the platforms of the world so that some young Shakespeare born tomorrow will find the tools that she needs to share her genius. And so that's what I hope people will take, this appreciation of why we want to embrace new technologies and what they do, which is to increase the choices and possibilities and freedoms and options that we have, that we all have. And we want to bring those to as many people of the world and those yet to be born. And that's why we want to embrace the general trend of progress, even though it brings incredible new problems all the time, almost as many new problems as solutions. But in those problems are the choices and the possibilities that are increasing. And so that's why we do this. And I think if I could spread that gospel, I'd be happy.
So final question for me. As things start to ease up and we can get a little bit back to normal, who knows what that's going to look like? What are you looking forward to? And what's next on your horizon? What's your next project or your next kind of activity that you're involved in?
Well, somewhat surprising to me, I've lost my appetite for travel. I don't really care about going anywhere. I've seen so much. I feel like I want to kind of hunker down. And the COVID, you know, lockdown has been suited me perfectly. I'm perfectly fine with that. I have everything I need in my little studio here. But where my mind wanders to, it wanders to this question that I don't have a very good answer. I know nothing. I mean, I have no answers, and that's sort of why I'm intrigued by it. And the question is, what would a really good world government look like? Hmm. What does world governance, how could that possibly be democratic or something that we would want and effective at the same time? There's all kinds of issues of like, you know, what if you objected? Where do you go? Right now, you move to a different country. Okay, but if it's a one world government, there's no escape. Maybe the escape is in VR, virtual reality, the Oasis. I don't know. But that was the question. It's like, how would a really good world government that you would find, you know, if you're on a Star Trek planet, if, you know, if you visit another galaxy and they've got their, you know, million-year-old civilization, that's obviously going to be a planetary government. How does it work in a way that everybody wants it? And I don't know, but that's what I am thinking about.
Does that need to be born out of something external to us? You know, when we become a multi-planetary species or something? And then,
well, yeah. Does it require that kind of a alien threat to make us do it? I don't know. It's possible that we might have to have some serious catastrophe to actually bring us together, to elevate us, to help us transcend nation states. I mean, the problem is, in my reckoning, without getting too much into it, the problem is this idea of national sovereignty. You cannot have national sovereignty beliefs in a world government. And by that, it means that one of the geniuses of, say, the reason why we have peace, say, in North America between states is that if someone harms me, causes me an injustice, I do not have the right to seek justice on my own. And the same thing among states. If one state harms another state, California does not have the right to seek justice on its own. You have an impartial police. So I'm not a pacifist, I'm a policifist. I believe in police having force to enforce the peace and to arbitrate the harm that one party does to another. If you don't have that, then you just have endless feuding. And that's exactly what we have at the global level, because states like the United States believes that they have some right to enforce or seek justice if someone harms them. And that's just totally crazy. You have to have a world police that says, oh, no, okay, you're harmed, we'll take it to the court, we'll work through this process. And if there is some punishment, we'll met it out. You don't get to infect it. And so that requires giving up this idea of national sovereignty, which is a huge, huge step. And one of the most reluctant to do it is the US. And so, yeah, so it's hard to imagine how you get there, but I think you have to get there.
Mm. Well, that's an interesting intellectual challenge for you. Maybe a certain level of population expansion might also kind of be a trigger.
Well, we're going to see the other thing that happens. This is over long term. We didn't talk about this. There's a population implosion happening right now, and we have nothing we've tried has stopped it. So paying money, just to be clear, what it means is that the replacement level in the population, the fertility level has dropped below the replacement level in most countries, including developing countries like Iran and China. So they're all getting older very, very fast. And paying people to have babies, nothing works to raise the average above replacement level. So that means that for the, you know, after the peak around 2070 or so, all we can see forward after that is every year fewer humans born. Something might change, but that's the project. And even for the rest of the century, what it means is that the average age is getting older over time. The peak youth was 1972. That was the peak youth year. And from then, the average age of the planet has been getting older and will continue to do so, as far as we can see, forever. So that prospect of having, how do we have an economy, let alone whether it's global or not, but have any economy where every year there's fewer people, fewer customers, smaller audience, fewer people to work. It's very hard to see how we have rising living standards. We've never in history of planet had rising living standards with decreasing population. So we don't know how to do that yet. That's a kind of a bummer way to end, but that is something I do worry about. And so while I am a huge optimist about the coming decades, as I said, that's not going to happen in 15 years. What's going to happen in 15 years is that we're going to have an economic boom. Lots of things going on within my lifetime anyway, it's going to be pretty good. After I'm gone, who knows?
Well, moment of optimism. Oh, I must ask you one final question, actually. You advised Steven Spielberg on Minority Report. What was that experience like? And what do you think 2050 is going to look like now? I mean, we've pointed at it a little bit. But,
Yeah, he recruited a bunch of us together into a hotel for a weekend to try to imagine the year 2050. And many things from that room made it into the movie. Many didn't. I learned the one thing I learned from him, from Spielberg, about that experience was really, really kind of cool in terms of thinking about the future, was that, you know, as I said, the future's like to wave their arms and make general trends. And he said, no, this doesn't work for me. I have to film this. I have to have very, very specific things. I want to know, what does the bedroom look like? I want to know what you're going to eat for breakfast. And so that kind of being very, very specific forced an interesting exercise in, you know, being wrong and making up things. But that going that specific was actually a useful exercise. And so I learned from him that while it's in the end, you can only make general trends, it is a useful exercise along the way to try and you know, like say, well, what does the music sound like in 2015? What are they going to be playing in the background? Are they going to be playing instruments? What does that look like? And so those kinds of questions, like kind of the museum of the future idea, is a really good, useful exercise to go through.
That's a very cool thing to have done.
Yeah.
Excellent. Kevin, on that note, we're going to say farewell to you. Thank you so much for your time. That was really, really exciting to talk to you. And I know our listeners will take a tremendous amount from it. So thank you.
Well, thank you for your great questions. I really appreciate this opportunity to be here. And I appreciate your attention to my work. So thank you.
Until next time, the world is evolving. Are you?